Good afternoon, folks. It is 12:30 in studio with Kevin here on CKMS 102.7 FM, Radio Waterloo. We are also broadcasting on Rogers Digital 946 and worldwide at radiowaterloo.ca/listen. And on this beautiful, maybe a true Friday of spring, we've tried to have a few of those, and you must be good luck, Mike. I'm speaking with Mike Brigham from SolarShare. Welcome, Mike. I think you're good luck, because I know on at least two of my previous Fridays, and these aren't December, January ones, these are March, April ones, my first discussion ended up being all about snow. And I'm hoping now we can have the discussion to say, okay, after today, maybe there's no more snow.
I took my snow brush out, so they better not be.
I hope so, yeah. So thanks so much for coming out. We've got tons we can talk about. We already started a chat and almost didn't make it here on time because I was talking so much. As I wrote in one of the intros for the show that I put on Facebook, I put a little recap of how we met, which was, now I said 2003, and I think that's about, I mean, give or take a year.
Yes.
But I very much remember that because it was a Prius meeting that I had organized in Mississauga, and there was me and two other people, and we were like, well, I guess that's it. Let's go to have lunch or something. And then this Prius shows up, and it was Mike Brigham, and we've been kind of connected since.
Those were the early days. That's when there were way more Ferraris on the road than there were Priuses.
Absolutely, yeah. And so what year, I was trying to remember, was yours a 2001?
I got mine in August of 2000. I think I was about the 15th in Ontario to get one.
Okay.
And pretty exciting technology.
I mean, I know we're going back. I'm sure people are listening going, oh, no, I didn't know this was a history show.
Bunch of old guys.
Yeah, but I mean, it was at that time, it was amazing technology. I mean, it's still amazing technology because it really laid the groundwork for a lot of stuff. But was David Suzuki the first Canadian to get a Prius?
I heard that Toyota specifically held other cars from other people so that he could be the first. Yes.
Yeah, and but they were. I mean, that was a long, long time ago. And just maybe take us through, Mike. What have you after that Prius? What was your collection of cars to get you to where you are today?
That first Prius was just a really nice little car to drive. Very, very good in all respects. Very dependable. Very few problems with it. Mm-hmm. I was actually wanting to get into a pure electric vehicle because EVs were really what turned my crank. And around 2010, I think it was around then that General Motors became insolvent. And I'd been watching the development of their Volt and rumors of an electric vehicle after that, and I thought, this is a moonshot. They're not gonna bring it out now if they even survive. So I went ahead and bought a 2010 Prius. Mm-hmm. And then what does GM do but surfaces 2 years later and says, oh, and here we have the Volt, which is the half electric, you know, with a gas engine generator backup. Mm-hmm. And I took one test drive in one of those, and I had mine on order the very next week and sold my 2010 Prius and took a bath. But I'm now driving a pure electric vehicle, a Chevy Bolt, like as in lightning bolt. Mm-hmm. I've now got a year under my belt with that, and I have some very strong feelings about EVs now, and we're all going to be driving one, and we're all going to be very happy that we're driving one. I think people have some big misconceptions. I think mainly three. One used to be that they're slow, and I think if anybody knows anybody or has heard anything about Teslas, they know that electric vehicles are now like about the fastest on the road if you're driving a Tesla. One of the others is that they're expensive to buy. And, you know, they cost a little bit of a premium over regular cars. But when you factor in no oil changes, no tune-ups, no exhaust to repair, due to regenerative braking, you really don't use your regular braking system. And, you know, in the case of my car, the first time I have to see a dealer to maintain the warranty is 250,000 kilometers.
For any visit at all, that's your first visit.
Well, they want to have you in to change wiper blades and, you know, rotate tires and stuff, but, you know, nothing that you actually have to go in for. And at 250,000 kilometers, all they're going to do is change your battery coolant and do another inspection.
Wow.
It's really, really not much. And the fuel cost is a fraction, I, for $8, I can drive, for instance, from Toronto to Guelph, you know, to my girlfriend's place, and then we can drive up to Parry Sound to the cottage. That cost me about $8. And then I had them install just a regular wall outlet at the marina because I have to boat to my island. And I plug in there, and they just let me charge for free. So they pay for my trip home. So my cottage commute, which is the better part of 600 kilometers if you go via Guelph, cost me
$8. $8, 600 kilometers, and just using today's prices, do you even know what would that be in a regular fueled car? Like
I think it depends entirely on...
There is no regular because of the gas range.
Yeah.
I know as a comparative, I find 10 liters per 100 is a... I just find it's a good number to use for cars because it's easy to do math with.
Yeah.
And I know, like, for instance, we have a RAV4 at home, a 2010 RAV4, that averages city highway combined about 10, maybe slightly under. And if you drive any kind of, I'd say anything but a economical car, you're going to be pretty close to 10 on average. So 600 kilometers...
Well, again, 10 liters is what, about $13?
Yeah.
So 13 gives you every 100. So 6 times 13 is what, about $80?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So I'm
84. So how's our math there? No. So 78.
So $78 costs me about $8.
So 10%. Yeah. So 1/10. And
now this may be, that's me getting a free charge on the way home.
But then it would be 1/5.
Still. But you know what? But that is also one of the things when people talk about, you know, the range and the cost. Let's just talk about and stick with cost for a moment. You know, I have solar systems. I have to travel out to Kingston to check on and so on. And I drive to Kingston. I charge up at home. I drive to Kingston. I don't have to stop, you know, midway. I stay at a hotel there that has a free charging station. So I charge there before I come home. And again, you know, Toronto to Kingston in return is $8. Or I stop at a friend's place and I plug in there. You know, there are so many places where you get free charging. And in some cases, the fast chargers, where you can add in 1 hour about 250 kilometers worth of range, in some cases are free. They're putting them in so that you'll shop in the nearby mall or eat in the restaurant. And so these things just drop the cost of ownership amazingly. The single Achilles heel that people have concerns about that is somewhat founded today, but getting better, and that is, you know, where will I have enough options for recharging? And you know, sometimes that can be, you have to think ahead and you have to plan your stops a little bit. It's not as effortless as driving a gasoline car. But, you know, with a bit of planning, it's a pretty minor deal, and it's getting better every day because more and more charging stations are going in. And, you know, once you've driven 3 hours, you know, you probably want to stop for a meal and stuff anyway. So, hey, you might as well plug the car in and have lunch or dinner and, you know, Bob's your uncle when you leave. The only problem is when you hit a broken down charger, which I've hit a couple now, but I think, again, it's growing pains. It's, people don't report when one's broken, and so the next person comes in thinking they have a working charging station, and they don't. But I think that's just growing pains and stuff. And but the offsetting factor in all of this is these things are so damn fun to drive. I mean, when you step on the gas pedal, unlike a gasoline car, you have 100% of the available horsepower from a standing start. You can't compare it to a gasoline car. You know, in a gasoline car, you know, the engine has to rev up to reach its full power, which is why Teslas, for instance, where they have four-wheel drive so they can get traction, can just smoke just about anything else on the road from the light, because you have 100 horsepower from a dead standstill. And I'm here to tell you, it's fun. In fact, you have to get used to not being a little too enthusiastic on the stop weights, because you lay rubber like a teenager.
So did you cover, you said there was three main misconceptions.
The first one was that they're slow, which I think people are understanding now. No, they're
false.
Not.
Yeah.
The second one is that they're expensive. Well, they maybe cost a little more up front, but when you factor in how inexpensive they are to drive after that, and on the balance of things, I would say they're no more expensive than a car of comparable quality and features and so on.
Which is a key point, yeah. So just before you go to your third one, I think that's one worth just touching on, because It's funny because even in the Prius days when we'd have the same conversation about a hybrid versus a gas only, cost was a factor people would bring up. So it still applies today to EVs, is people will immediately go to, well, what's your return on this? How much are you going to save? And they apply that, what I call a special standard, to that purchase that is not applied at all to any of the gas cars. Nobody ever buys a gas car and says, I wonder how much money I'm going to save. Or very few, I shouldn't say nobody, but I mean, it's not a discussion point.
They're very fast depreciating assets. The only thing that depreciates faster than a car generally is a computer. Mm-hmm. Well, do you get a return from your computer? Well, you need it for what you do, just as you do with the car.
To buy it, it's unfair, I think, to apply a standard to one half of the equation. I mean, the reality is, and it's a question I used to ask, and people would roll their eyes and stop the discussion, because they'd say, well, if you have leather seats in your car and that costs $1,500, or you have a GPS and that costs, back in the day, $3,000 for a nav system, have you calculated your return versus buying paper maps?
That's right.
And they look at me like I'm the weirdo. Now, we can all agree that they may not be wrong, but that's neither here nor there. The reality is that there's a lot more that goes into purchasing something. That is a component, but certainly sort of applying this extra standard of, okay, well, you need to save whatever premium you've paid up front. You have to save it to validate your purchase. It's a ridiculous, I think, standard.
Well, and the non-monetary equation on the whole thing is this. I think the number of people who are actually doubting man-made climate change existing, I think, is decreasing, thank God. I can't believe that we're not a lot brighter as a society than we are. But if you factor in, if you commute to work any real distance any day, so, I mean, if you're a daily driver in your car, you know, compared to, putting LED lights in your house and re-insulating and putting in a more efficient furnace and a more efficient hot water tank and so on, they pale by comparison to the greenhouse gas reductions that you can achieve simply by switching from a gas-powered car to electric or diesel to electric. Same thing.
Right.
The benefit that the planet gets is astounding, because just about all of Ontario's electricity generation right now is from non-emitting or low-emitting sources. You shouldn't get me started on nuclear.
We will, with one glaring exception that we'll put on the table for if we have time.
That's right.
But I like you put that well. So it's directly emissions producing from a greenhouse gas perspective.
Exactly. It's very efficient in terms of resources.
Upwards of 80% of our electricity.
90.
Upwards of 90.
Upwards of 90 currently,
that's
right
pretty
now.
High.
And it's getting, and I dare say it's going to get better as more renewables come into the mix, as they're coming in quickly. There's still a small proportion, but they're coming in. But, you know, if you really want to have an impact on, you know, trying to do your part for climate change, this is a change that you can do that is actually fun. I mean, I haven't met anybody who's bought an electric car and doesn't say, wow, these are a lot of fun to drive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people buy cars a lot quite often because, you know, they're shiny and they're fun to drive. Well, guess what? You know, there really aren't a lot of hardships with EVs. You have to just sort of get beyond the, oh, where will I charge it, you know, question, because there's a lot of those. You touched on something else. You may remember in the early days, people would say, oh, yeah, well, you save on gas. Oh, but how long are the batteries going to last?
That was a good one. Oh, and they're going to... still don't have an answer because they're still going.
That's right. Well, they're going to cost $1 million and they'll only last 2 years. You know, it was ridiculous. Well, the first Tesla information, high mileage results are out. And Tesla owners who, and a number of them, quite a number, have reached the 160,000 mile mark.
Okay.
And the decrease in battery life has proven to be only 10%, which is about half of what they thought it would be.
So it's even better than...
Even better. And apparently, the average miles put on a North American car before it's retired on average is about 140,000 miles, so 220,000 kilometers.
Okay.
So people have already passed that, and the batteries are still doing 90% as well as they did. And if you drive, you know, a Tesla or a Bolt, you know, if you had 10% of the power gone, you still got gobs. Like, there's still plenty left. Mm-hmm. They deem that the batteries are still completely satisfying to the drivers and satisfactory overall at 80% remaining.
Right.
So that you're talking about the life of the car.
Exactly. Because, I mean, again, to take the comparison fairly, if you're driving any car that's got a 250,000 kilometers on it or somewhere in that range, very few people would still have the same expectations that all around this is the car is acting like it was the day I took it off the lot. You can pour thousands in and rebuild engines, repaint cars and whatnot. But just taking care of regular maintenance, cars will get aged, you know, comfortable, as we might say. Mine's a very well-loved car. It's a bit more anecdotal, but it's stuff that I think people can relate to. And that, you've been driving either a hybrid or a pure electric for
17 years.
17 years.
Yeah.
I would come in at about 15 years. And of course, during that time, both of us have been rather vocal about encouraging other folks. So we've, through our, I'll chalk it up to our great convincing skills, but I think it's also just due to the fact that birds of a feather flock together, but yeah. We're surrounded by folks that also drive similar cars, hybrids and EVs. And I mean, I can tell you from my own experience directly that I've seen lots and lots of heavy work put on these cars, the Prius in particular, just being used and abused as a vehicle. Car enthusiasts will just cringe when I say this, but to me, these oil change guidelines, they're just guidelines. They're like 8,000, 16,000. I'm like at 24,000. I just was not very religious with that at all. And the Prius didn't really care too much. I'm sure it wasn't pleased if it could talk, but I didn't baby the car myself. I saw more than one go over, one got over 400,000 before I had to say bye to it. The first one that I ever had got transferred within the business. Somebody else was driving it, and it only ended its career because of an accident. And the driver, a good friend of mine that worked for me at the time, was so sad. You know, not that he got injured in the accident. It was minor in terms of injury, but the damage relative to the age of the car made it such that financially it was a write-off. He wanted me to buy it and rebuild it. He loved that car. And it had, 10 years and several hundred thousand. The one I have now is well over 200,000. Mm-hmm. My dad's got a Prius that's over 300,000. And compared to him, I'm a stellar car owner, put it that way. I don't think he knows what an oil change is.
I think we've proven that the battery concerns are not, they're not real.
It happens. I mean, I'm sure just like anything, right? Anything happens, but it's a non-issue by and large. And the warranty, I don't know this Chevy one, but the Prius one was 8 year, 160,000 on all electrical components, including the battery.
I think it's similar. Well, cars today are very sophisticated and, you know, the engineering is unbelievably sophisticated, but the average internal combustion car, you know, with a regular transmission, has over 2,000 moving parts.
Mm.
My car has 18 moving parts.
You're kidding.
So, wow, that's, you know, yeah, that's so there's very few moving parts to be worried about. And electric motors, how often does anybody remember wearing out an electric motor? They go and go and go forever. So it's really sort of a case of, you know, do you trust the electronics? And again, our cars all have computers. They all have multiple computers. You cannot buy a car today that's not operated, you know, the engine and the powertrain and so on, by computers. So you're not going to get away from them. This just has heavier duty electronics and more of them.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a much more mature technology. So you've had, you said, so the Bolt... maybe just for the benefit of the audience, and then we'll move on. I want to talk to you about your a lot of the solar stuff. But in the EV world where we can speak personal experience, you've had the Bolt, the Volt, and then the Prius.
A 2010 Prius and a 2001 Prius.
Which is of course the hybrid, and
yes.
But it's, you know, was really the first successful car in North America to drive that drive it forward, and it's. Do you find it funny or interesting that Toyota is still stubbornly resisting putting an electric car, and they seem to have no plans to do so?
They apparently are going the fuel cell route.
Yeah.
And
which is hydrogen. Is that what you mean by fuel cell?
It can be hydrogen, or it can be natural gas. But yeah, basically hydrogen.
Are they the only ones? As far as I know, they're on their own path with this.
I'm not sure, but it has surprised me, because the whole rest of the world is going the other way, and with the whole world going the rest of the way, there's even more money going into battery technology.
Mm-hmm.
And the batteries, you know, when you can get a car, I mean, mine's rated in the summer at 380 kilometers range. The Teslas, you can get up to 500 kilometer range.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who really needs, you know, more than that? So, you know, there isn't really a technological barrier. And last I heard, fuel cells still cost about $30,000, not the car, just the fuel cell. So,
wow, that's pretty significant.
I'm not going to be seeing that in a $30,000 or $40,000 car anytime soon. But, you know, Toyota's, they're a smart bunch of people.
Yeah.
So they must know something.
I've been surprised. I mean, I was a huge, huge fan, obviously, when the... and it's funny how things shift. I mean, things never stay the same. Because I remember when I had the Prius, and well before, because the Volt was a long time coming, because I was at, and I think we may have been there, but I was at an auto show, I want to say it was 2007, that they had a prototype Volt, but I went up to the GM fella and I said, this is a great idea for the future, because it was just a prototype, it was an idea, although thinking back on it, whatever they had out there looked very much like the Volt.
You and I were at that show together.
I think that's
and we part. Saw it was a black one, and part of the inside was like felt covered cardboard, because they didn't have an interior.
But it ended up looking close.
Very close.
But I remember talking to the fellow saying, you know, when are you guys going to do some hybrid stuff? Like this electric, it at the time struck me as, you know, future.
Yeah.
And they were scoffing. They're like, you know, hybrid, that's toys.
Yeah.
We're doing the real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was maybe 6 to 9 months after that everything fell apart with the Volt, and that was going to be the end of that. Thankfully, I think it was, Bob Lutz, I don't know if I'm saying his name right,
yes.
But I think he was the guy that probably saved everything from what bits I can understand.
But do you know the reason that is quite often touted in the industry as to why GM did such a good job with the Bolt? I mean, the Volt was intended to be a stepping stone to give them experience for the Bolt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's widely regarded that the Bolt was built because GM has to meet standards, particularly in California, by the California Air Resources Board,
mm-hmm.
for the average fuel economy. And all the big car companies make the biggest markups on, you know, pickup trucks and SUVs. And
right.
Most popular truck in the States, or maybe even in Canada, is like a Ford F-150 pickup.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable for us in an urban environment, but that is the most popular mm-hmm. vehicle. Well, if they can't meet the efficiency standards for the fleet as a whole, for every extra Bolt that they sell, where they're, I believe, losing money, they can probably afford to sell two more SUVs, and the profit margin on the SUVs more than compensates
mm-hmm.
for what the Bolt loses them. And so the Bolt is so hard to get. Most everybody, you can't find one at a dealer. You can't test drive them. You have to wait 5 months to get
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
We think somebody, some accountants at GM are basically saying, how many Bolts do we want to sell this month to meter out in order just to meet the standards so we can sell in California and some of the other states similarly. So their heart was in it to make something that could really sell well, but possibly only so that if they put them out there, they would definitely sell, so that they could sell more of the gas guzzlers in California.
Yeah, I don't have hard facts, but...
Nobody does.
But I have heard from... Let me try one of these things that seems to get you elected to office. A lot of people are saying, Mike, I've heard a lot of people saying, so it's got to be true, and I might have heard it on some crazy radical TV show, but the Bolt production, so the funny thing is the Bolts are made in Michigan, which is great for folks that want to support local economies, that's great stuff, and they have a full, they've got capacity and potential capacity. It's not like this thing is sitting up in the middle of nowhere. It's right in the outskirts of Detroit, but California, I believe Quebec, and there's a third jurisdiction that escapes me. I want to say Portland, but I'm kind of guessing. But that have, just like California, have mandates on the manufacturers. So essentially, as I understand it, whatever capacity they can build at the current capacity that they've chosen. They're first filling these mandate places, and whatever's left is like, oh, okay, we got three left. Let's shoot one up to Ontario or wherever else people might want them.
I don't think you're far off.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say the other one, because what we're seeing, why I bring Quebec into this, which is A, great that we have a Canadian jurisdiction that seems to understand that California, it's not an accident, to your point. It's not because people in California, all out of the goodness of their heart, just decided, ooh, let's all drive electric cars or hybrids. California has had the strictest emissions standards and has been the leader in environmental policy as a government in the world, and it's a state, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're really leading, which is creating those results.
Yes.
Like, you can't not be hit by a, if you're going to hit get hit by a car in California, it's probably going to be an EV, you know? So that's maybe a strange way to look at it, but they're, you know, I still, every Tesla I see in town, and I do see one once a day on average now, which is great. That's incredible. But that quickly becomes, even many years ago when I was in California, trying to count, I used to count Priuses, and then I switched to counting electric cars. I couldn't even count Volts out there, and this was a few years ago.
Yeah.
There's too many of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Shouldn't care.
Well, if you're in Toronto, you can easily see, six or eight Tesla sightings a day. Easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
Which is incredible when you consider that their mass market car is still not here. It's, I mean, the first ones, some have shipped, but I don't believe any have shipped into Canada.
I don't think so.
I know a fella that is one of the first. I don't know if he's the first, but he's on the list. He just got final pricing like a month ago.
Yeah.
So we're still talking, I think, late summer or something like that. It's imminent, but I mean, they're trickling. They're going to trickle, and the plant stopped right now.
Yeah, it's amazing. The Teslas you see are all $100,000 cars.
That was the thing. I mean, I've seen lots of the Model X's, beautiful car, and then, of course, the different Model S's. And so just quickly, I wanted to mention to interested folks, we focused on those ones because that's what we know, but Nissan has had the Nissan Leaf out for years.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a much more limited range than the Bolt, but I mean, I know quite a few people that drive Leaf, and they can work with it. They simply don't have a lifestyle that requires them to have a car that needs to go more than 200 kilometers in a setting without a charge time.
And the second generation, which is out now,
I think it's out now,
and it's got, what, 50% more range?
It's got more range. It's still lower than the Bolt.
It's like, quite a bit lower than the Bolt, but it's...
The Bolt and the Tesla 3, as far as I can understand, are the only two that sit in this range of, no pun intended, of having enough range to satisfy the our standard that we've set of 400 kilometers.
I think
up,
so, yeah.
Which is only a standard because we got used to it with our cars. Because I can tell you I don't remember, but when the first gas cars came out, there was not gas stations on every corner where you could, you know, tank 16 cars at once and then drive for 500 kilometers,
no.
Right? There was one guy with a 10, and so people forget that they're trying to get, you know, compare all those things. But so Nissan, the Mitsubishi is one I looked at. I looked at very briefly.
The MI-EV, yeah.
There's a few around. I personally found it a very big disappointment. That's the one car I test drove, and I'm glad I did, because I would never get one of those at that price.
Yeah. Volkswagen has out the e-Golf now.
Yeah.
I have a friend with one, and he's totally tickled with it.
Yeah.
And it's doing way better in the quote-unquote fuel economy during the winter months,
okay,
which is the one time of year when EVs
really
have the range go down quite a bit.
He doesn't have that hit, is what you're saying?
Not as bad a hit. Now, you know, he's driving country roads, and I'll tell you, there's a big difference,
yeah,
I've found, between driving 80 kilometer an hour country roads versus sitting on the 401 at 115 or 120.
Mm-hmm.
At that speed, you're pushing a lot of air, and it takes, you know, a lot of power. And it's sort of interesting. I don't know if most people know it, but when you're driving a gasoline car, you know, your gas gauge says you've got, you know, a third of a tank left. Well, it's up to you to know how far you're going to go on that third of a tank.
Mm-hmm.
On any electric vehicle on the market, you have a digital number on your fuel cluster that tells you your expected range remaining, and it usually modifies it according to how fast you're going, the air temperature, how much heat are you, or air conditioning are you using, you know, how much braking and accelerating are you doing. It factors all this in, and it constantly gives you a number. So you can always say, I've got, you know, 250 left, or I've got 100 left, or whatever. It gives you a far more accurate idea than a gasoline car, where a third of a gauge, well, I don't know how far of a third of a gauge goes in a truck or a car. You'd have to drive it to know. An EV tells you, you can be any idiot, it tells you how many, and you just have to judge, you know, when you're going to want to change. One additional point I should make too, people who are concerned about range with EVs, I say, well, do you leave your garage every morning with a totally full tank? Probably not. I mean, a lot of times I used to go and I'd suddenly, you know, I had like five meetings I had to go to during the day, and I'd leave the garage and go, oh crap, I'm on an eighth of a tank. Well, with an EV, you know, if you just know you're going out the next day, you just make sure that you do plug in that night and you leave with the full tank.
Right.
And you don't have to worry about where there even is a gas station. Charging, recharging only becomes an issue when you're traveling.
Right.
You know, if you're going to be doing 380 kilometers of round town driving, I don't know, you must be a taxi or something, you know, or a maniac. It's really only traveling, you know, quote unquote, cross country when you have to really worry about it. So anyway, just...
Those are all good points. And it's you know, even that, what you said about the range or about telling you the remaining range, these are all things that we've just conditioned ourselves to get used to, because I think if we just created sort of today's greatest gas, maybe not today, because probably some high-end gas cars of today, 50,000 and up, might be able to do those kind of conversions as well, but it's not standard. But if you, the idea of a car that says, well, I'm going to tell you how much stuff is left, that you then are basically on the fly in your head going to figure out, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because who actually cares? You know, there's 4 liters in your car. What does that mean? It means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you have to know this car. You have to actually know that, okay, that gauge there, realistically, if I drive this way and the weather's that way and a whole bunch of stuff, means probably I'll make it to the gas station. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you as a person that was never, those were not built for people like me, because I've run out of gas so many times in my life because I just refuse to pay attention. I like to bend reality to my will. And it turns out running out of gas doesn't work. I've done it several times in a hybrid, I'm not proud to announce. I've posted a few times in the gas stations, but so it's you know, it's a valid point. It won't prevent people like me, because I'll see the sign that says you have 3 kilometers, and I'm like, that probably means 8.
Yeah.
And I'll keep going, but it's, you know, you can't stop everything.
Well, in an EV, you start to see other things happen too. I mean, you know, you start to see your fuel indication go from green, in my case, to orange.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts, says, you know, low, you know, recharge as soon as possible. And then a while later, you get a message up saying propulsion power is reduced,
you know,
due to low battery. And so you don't have 100% of your horsepower left.
So it's forcing you now to say, you better go charge now.
It's saying, I'm starting to take control because you seem to be an idiot.
Yeah, okay.
and believe, I've been on that warning, and I've where the car supposedly has 50 kilometers left, I've done 80.
Okay.
And at night, you know, in a bit of rain, you know, a little bit of a nail biter and stuff, but
sure.
You know, you just slow down and, you know, take it gently and stuff. But it's funny, our paradigms are what we judge by.
Mm-hmm.
But
absolutely.
Can you imagine, I'd say, Kevin, I got 2 cars here today that, you know, I want to sell you. Okay, you know, this one is you know, going to be, you know, $35,000. And it'll cost you about $500 a year to run. It's electric. You basically just have to plug it in, and maybe about your third year, you know, you'll go in to visit a dealer, you know, on the thing. Or I've got this other car over here. This is a gasoline car. This has about 2,200 moving parts. You're going to need to get oil changes, tune-ups, and spark plugs, and after 3 years, an exhaust system, and it's going to, it'll be a little less expensive, not 35, maybe 30,000. But it's going to cost you about $2,000 a year to run. But those 2,200 parts are probably going to be okay. You know, the one with 18 parts is, a lot more dependable. But but you can save 5,000 right off the bat.
Yeah.
Coming out of our paradigm right now, we don't think of things that way. But if you're offered those two options and you'd never driven either, you know, do you want to drive the one that costs $2,000 less a year to operate, even though it costs $5,000 more? I mean, it's a pretty fast break even.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to drive the one that has way, way fewer parts, that has instant acceleration, that's smoother, that's quieter, that doesn't idle, that doesn't make fumes, that helps the planet? Like, to me, it's a no-brainer.
Absolutely. I mean, it's you know, I'm very confident. I don't know the timelines, but I'm confident that we're moving in that right direction. I mean, I think we'd be there a lot sooner. The reality is, I think there's a lot of interests that are, you know, like anything that changes, we've focused on a lot of the positive changes for the planet, for people as a whole, but individually, you're not doing this strictly because you're not actually making your life worse as a driver. You're enjoying your drive, so you're not sacrificing. So there's something in it for you. But there's the big interests of, you know, of the fossil fuel industry, and it's a big, it's a huge industry, and you're getting into politics and people's lives at that level. They will resist. They will come up with reasons, and, you know, but it's not that long ago. It's 20, 30 years ago. But, I mean, there used to be lead in we used to leave it up to the consumer to decide, would you like to put lead in every time you fill up your car? Would you like to have the gasoline that has lead in it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't even know if is it still called unleaded gas? I still think of it as that. I don't think it's labeled that way anymore.
No.
Tell you how old I am. But, I mean, literally, I remember one day they said, well, you know, we're going to stop this option. But the leaded option was 5 cents cheaper or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the gas companies nor the consumers that even the consumers who had the choice, people could have just stopped buying it and then the gas companies would have stopped. But it was 5 cents cheaper. So somebody had to step in, the government. You know, people often say, oh, we don't want the government deciding anything.
Mm-hmm.
Stop me if I go on a rant. But I was thinking about this today, and I'll... The country south of us that shall remain nameless, because I'm not trying to make it about them, but I just find it interesting, very, very interesting, how you have the leader of the government constantly interfering in every little bit and nook and cranny and everything, and the quote-unquote folks that all seem to be the defenders of individual freedoms and the freedom of business and small government are quite happy to encourage this meddling of somebody that literally is the government. He's the embodiment of the government, and he's, oh, oil prices are too high, or this company isn't making it, is not doing this right. That sounds like a lot of government interference to me, and not the good kind. So, small rant over. Why I brought that up was it took the intervention of the government working on behalf of the people, saying, you know what, lead and gasoline, not a good idea. It's probably not something we should be shoving in the vehicles that we then drive around in and spend our time in. Let's stop that. And we got there, and it would be ludicrous today. I mean, I would like to hope if somebody found out that you could buy leaded gas somewhere, they wouldn't all run there to save 5 cents. They'd say, hey, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Shut him down. So maybe we'll get that way one day. We'll go, why are you pouring gasoline into your vehicle? Plug it in.
Well, I hope what is a sign of the times, I don't know if you read it, the president of Shell Oil globally, who mm-hmm. is what, third largest petroleum company,
okay.
is now driving a Volvo electric vehicle.
Great.
And he has gone on record as mm-hmm. saying, hey, you know, we know where things are going.
Yeah.
Our job is to shift with the times and stay relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So... unlike Exxon, you know, they're not sticking their heads in the sand and out the back door shoveling money out to private interest groups that are trying to create doubt that, you know, there's man-made climate change.
Right.
You know, Shell is saying, yeah, we get it. Mm-hmm. So we're preparing to shift our business model accordingly, and I'm not embarrassed to drive an electric vehicle. So, you know, there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, yeah. So let's hope, you know, and I like I said, I'm confident. Let's talk a little bit about renewables, which is ties in, but I want to make sure we spend a bit of time specifically on what you do these days. So Solar Share
yes.
is the proper name. Okay, so Solar Share is a cooperative that you co-founded and are president of. So
yes.
tell us about that.
I have had a cottage property up north that I've had off-grid since 1985. And living with solar has made me such a passionate supporter of solar. It's such a dependable, benign, clean form of energy
mm-hmm.
that I realized we should have more and more of, that when a bunch of circumstances, when the stars aligned in 2010, a group that I was affiliated with, the group that was actually responsible for the wind turbine at Exhibition Place in Toronto being erected,
mm-hmm.
which when you drive into the Garden Expressway, it's there, you know, big as life. You know, I said to them, you know, if you ever want to do solar, I'd be interested in helping out. And long story short, we founded a not-for-profit cooperative,
okay,
owned and controlled by its now 1,600 members. And our purpose was simply to promote solar energy. The question is, you know, how to do it. Mm-hmm. And so the model that we followed was we basically used private capital to build commercial scale solar systems across Ontario. And we're up to $60 million worth of these systems that we've built and we own since 2010.
Okay.
And what we do is we build these, and then once they're built, we actually say to the public, hey, how would you like to invest in, you know, one of Canada's top rated ethical investments? What you're investing in is made in Ontario solar systems that are maintained by people in Ontario, and the proceeds come to us, the cooperative and its members in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the sneaky hook that we use to get people to talk to us. I mean, when we say we offer 5-year bonds that earn 5% per year, or 15-year bonds that earn 6% per year,
mm-hmm,
people go, wow, that's a pretty darn good return, mm-hmm, you know. And you very quickly start getting into, you know, what are the risks? Well, what could go wrong? And in the process, we start to educate them on, you know, why solar is such a great energy source. I have financial people, because we have a number of charitable foundations that have invested in us,
okay,
quite a number now, actually, and they are all starting to follow a mandate where they want to see, it depends on the organization, but between 15 and 20% of any monies that they're holding on to, they want to see it doing some environmental good. They want to see a socially responsible investment, mm-hmm, that is benefiting society as a whole and the climate. And of course, solar share fits that in spades. So they're investing in us, and sometimes they sort of have trouble getting their heads wrapped around the finances, sort of the financial aspects of it. And fund managers are the same thing. And I'll say, mm-hmm, listen, do you want to, let me give you a really simple analogy. If I came to you and said, okay, with our money, we'd like you to invest in an apartment building. With our money, we've built it. It's brand new. It's been professionally engineered and designed. It's being professionally, you know, maintained by one of the largest companies of its kind in Ontario. We have it leased for full occupancy with exactly known fixed rates of rent for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Would you invest in that?
Mm-hmm.
And they go, well, at full occupancy? Well, duh, yeah, of course. And I said, well, it's exactly the same here.
Right.
Full occupancy means, you know, every kilowatt hour that we generate, we sell. We sell it at exactly a fixed rate. It doesn't go up with inflation. It's fixed. But
we know what it is for the next 20 years.
And it's guaranteed.
Right.
So the only two questions that come, that really arise in terms of what risk is first of all, well, how do you know how much it's going to generate? Well, I mean, we're typically plus or minus 2-3%. Like, we're not far off because we put so much time and effort into engineering the hell out of those estimates, and it's getting to be a very, very fine science.
You're able, obviously, with technology to measure. It's not, these are not hypothetical concepts. You're measuring what is actually being
yep,
produced, and you can adjust.
And you or anybody else or our members can go online, and we show our real-time generation. You can get right down to what an individual inverter or string is producing. How much has it done today, last 3 days, 7 days, year since it was built?
Mm-hmm.
You can do all sorts of graphs and charts. There are educational modules that teachers can use using our actual data to teach their students pre-done lessons, but where they go in and they can do exercises, mm-hmm, on our stuff. The only other question is, you know, how much are they going to cost to maintain? Well, you know, once you've built these things, there's not a lot of stuff to maintain. You want to,
again, you talked about earlier, there's no moving parts here.
No.
Like the, I should say there's none, but
some have cooling fans, some don't even have that.
Right. And do you have any that are tracking?
Actually, we now have some trackers, yes.
Is that the right term? So trackers,
yes,
are the ones where the panels follow the sun.
Exactly.
With a computer, so it's not, it's not some dude going up there for 50 a minute. So you have it, and the purpose is strictly to for increased efficiency.
Yes.
To maximize the,
that's
but
right.
Again, so when we talk moving parts, this is a very slow and very predictable move. It's going on a, what kind of angle are we talking about? over the course of the day?
It depends on the time of year, but from east to west, which is the major sweep, like there's north to south and there's east to west, or we call it azimuth and zenith. Hours go from about 35 degrees off vertical in one direction to 35 off vertical in the other, so 70 off 360. So they go about 290 degrees in terms of full. Did I do that math right? That sounds like too much. 190.
You said 360 minus 70 would be
290.
Sound like
a lot.
So in around. But that's over the course of many hours here.
Of a day.
If you visualize this, it's a moving part, but it's moving extremely slowly, which means you don't need any of the kind of stuff something going at 5,000 RPM here.
No.
This is very close to non-moving as you can get.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and we have.
Bring that up for folks that aren't following that is. No moving parts. Very hard for something completely passive to just break. Much harder.
Don't jinx it, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
Electronics do fail.
Yes, technically they just move at a smaller. Those are moving parts at a small level, but at almost quasi quantum level. But
that's
to your
right.
point, yes, you have electronics, but a much more reliable.
That's right. And these electronics now are being produced by companies that are. It's so competitive to try to get the most dependable, highest efficiency unit out there. You know, it's not tough. But in any case, so you know, we reel people in by talking about the great rate of return.
Yeah.
And then they get into talking about, well, what could go wrong? And we love getting into that because they start to get it. And we sell now pretty close to $1 million worth of bonds a month. And these days, for about the past 3 years, about half of that is people who have money invested who are adding more to their investments. So about half of it's from new members, about half of it is from members who are investing yet again. And we find that the average of our members has two or three investments with us. It seems like they sort of get in to get their feet wet, have a year to look around and see what's going, and maybe come to one of our, you know, annual general meetings and sort of hear what's discussed and see the caliber of people who make up the board, which is inspiring, awe-inspiring. When you see the people competing for board positions, it's pretty impressive. They start to realize, wow, like this group really has their act together. Mm-hmm. And the neat thing that's different between us and a company, a for-profit company that has to make widgets, is if they don't sell widgets this year, they're in a lot of trouble. If I couldn't find one more project to build or buy, and I'm the developer, I'm the lead of finding these opportunities, it doesn't matter because it's the projects that we have that are generating the money. I simply want to engage more people by building more systems. But right now we're forecast at the end of 20 years from now to have about a $7 million surplus if all goes well.
That would be owned by, or would be available to the members or for read
actually
something with at some point.
Because we're a not-for-profit, we cannot actually distribute it to the members by law. We have to do something benevolent with it.
Okay.
Because we are a not-for-profit. That's one of the things. You give up the ability to just spread that between your members by saying, we're going to be non-profit, which means we don't pay any tax.
Okay.
But that's our boo-boo fund.
Right.
So we can afford to really blow it by $7 million before anybody has to worry about a penny of returns not being there.
Gotcha. So it's a real safety cushion financially.
That's right.
And so just I want to clarify what you said there, because that's pretty key, I think, the difference you said between a for-profit and your situation. So, worst case, you just simply stop being able to find new projects from a new business perspective.
Yes.
100% of your existing members and investors are not impacted one bit by that.
Not at all.
So, you going and getting more business is simply opening more doors for the next. If I want to invest more, or somebody else wants to.
Yeah, if we can't find new projects to build, we cannot have more dollars of bonds outstanding than we have equity in our projects.
Right, okay.
And actually, we're pretty close to that point right now. If I don't get some new projects under our ownership in about 2 months, we may have to temporarily halt bond sales.
Okay.
But again, that just means we can't engage new people, or if you're an investor now, you won't be able to top up your investment. You could renew it. You know, the end of the 5 years comes and we say, you know, Mr. Hebert, you know, your bond is going to renew in 3 months. You can withdraw your money or you can reinvest it or you can reinvest less or more. Mm-hmm. We may not be able to take more.
That's a very compelling methodology, if you, in terms of how to do things, right? Mm-hmm. Because it takes a lot of the competing interests, I would say, that you find, unfortunately, in a regular business, where really, as soon as you're done whatever you're doing today, you now have this engine that needs to be supported by your future.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think just seems to fit in well with the same philosophy of you can spend your focus truly on developing, you know, finding the right projects to accomplish the underlying goal of increasing, you know, all of this is to increase solar energy, which by definition will decrease our reliance on non-renewable energy.
That's right. And it also gives people a very clearly ethical place to put their money. If you right. if you look at a lot of ethical funds, and people I know have looked at them, and it you can get into some pretty murky logic.
Yeah.
Like some of the ethical funds have invested in some of the tar sands companies. Or excuse me, oil sands. I'm supposed to use the politically correct term. I'm going to call them tar sands. they invest in them because they say, you know what, because we wield a big enough stick with the amount we invest, we say to them, listen, we're only going to invest if you do this or that to clean up your operation or to improve your employees, you know, safety for your employees or both
right.
or whatever.
We're fundamentally mitigating within
an evil,
a bigger problem still.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people, and I know them and I'm one of them, who say, you know what, I just don't want my money involved in the tar sands, period.
Right.
Like, I don't believe in them. I just don't want to be there. But, you know, if you're saying, well, but your money can do more good, you know, if you are. Well, maybe. But it starts to get complicated. Like, do those promises really come about? And are they as valid as I think? And so on. SolarShare is a much more dumbed down thing. You're investing in solar assets that generate clean electricity.
Full stop.
They generate it most when it's needed by the grid. They generate it where it's needed. It doesn't have to be transported 300 kilometers where there's all sorts of line losses.
Yeah.
It's a very safe form of generation. You know, we're concerned about, you know, nuclear accidents and stuff. Have you, do you know what the term is for a massive solar spill?
I didn't think there existed one.
A really nice day.
Oh dear. So you could, no, that's a good point. I was a little concerned. I thought, oh no, is there something I really don't understand? But no, point taken. And you bring that up, believe it or not, we are already creeping up to the end. So I'm glad you brought nuclear up, because I wasn't going to let you get out of here without a bit of talk.
Oh, you shouldn't get me started.
Well, I absolutely want to. Now, can we, and this is totally up to you, Mike, but, of course, we know we have fixed elections in Ontario, so we have a provincial election coming up.
Yep.
June 7th, the writ hasn't dropped, which simply means that the candidates are illegally campaigning now until the writ drops, at least the three major parties are. I think that's all it means. I'm not an expert. I'm just, I'm like Sean Hannity on Fox, except for the, is that I just say stuff, and then if it happened to be accurate, I call it news. So, I mean, they're in full non-campaign, pre-campaign mode and whatnot, but nuclear is, I haven't heard anything from the candidates, but I have seen all kinds of releases from OPG, or is it OPG or Hydro One? Somebody keeps sending out
OPG.
OPG, Ontario Power Generation, keeps sending, I feel like they're personal notes to me, letting me know that the expansion of Pickering or Darlington that they want to do?
Refurbs in Darlington and an extension to continue the operating license in Pickering with the existing plant.
Okay.
Which is already beyond its design life.
Yeah.
It's already the third oldest nuclear facility in North America.
Which is scary.
And it is the closest nuclear facility to a major metropolitan area.
In North America.
In North America. And to my knowledge, it's the only one built on a fault line.
Well, that's handy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the bits I know. I'm not throwing you a softball. The information I have is literally that I keep seeing that, and it's going to save the taxpayers a lot of money. So that's all I hear.
Well,
there's a little bit more to this. So we do not want them to expand this.
No. Just people hear, like, there are various tidbits that when you take them and you spin them a certain way, they make a sound bite.
Mm.
And OPG and the nuclear industry, of course, spin them to their benefit. But OPG, Ontario Power Generation, is on record as filing a rate increase request with the Ontario Energy Board for $13.8 billion worth of additional rate increase that they want to be brought in, phased in between now and 2023,
okay.
Which is 15 cents per kilowatt hour. And that is, and the what the public doesn't know is, you know, we have time of use billing for residential, where, you know, on three different time periods of the day, you pay different electricity rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because electricity rates for the producers, the major producers of electricity, are dealt with on a wholesale market that prices it per hour. It's okay. called the hourly energy price, or HOPE, misspelled.
Yeah.
And there are contracts where there's sort of, you know, bid and ask.
Right.
And basically it's the laws of supply and demand, where when the grid needs more power, and, you know, all the contracts have been sort of filled for the least expensive, you know, somebody looks around for where's the next least expensive form, and they bring that in. Well, the problem, one of the problems with nuclear is that it goes at one speed all the time.
Right.
And I liken that to, would you like to drive your car around Kitchener-Waterloo and then out on the 401 with your gas pedal fixed in one position? It doesn't work. We have so damn much nuclear generating at full tilt when we don't need it.
Right.
So they either give it away or in some cases pay large industrial users to consume it. Or they ship it out to another grid.
Right, because you can't. There's no practical way to store those amounts on a continuous basis.
Exactly.
And like you said, you can't turn it off, and
yep.
you can't just pour it. Like, it doesn't work like that. You can't just let it go somewhere. It has to go somewhere.
That's right. So, and so you know we have.
So the economics are not as truthful as what we're led to believe.
That's right. And also, when people talk about the average costs of electricity. Well, you know, an average is an average of, you know, day and night. Now, for instance, in the day, on a peak summer day, the price can be 10 or 20 times what it is normally on the wholesale market. And, you know, nuclear can't put out anymore. It's been going at full tilt, you know, it was at midnight, it's doing the same now. It doesn't help things at all. Solar kicks in.
Right.
When does solar generate most? On the middle of the hottest, sunniest summer days.
Yeah.
And so solar, and if you take a solar contract at 17 cents a kilowatt hour, and we're just about into building projects that will be at that low a price,
okay.
we're not generating at night.
Right.
And we're not generating that much in the early, early morning and the late, late evening, again, where it's not really needed. We generate only in the middle of the day. So we might be putting 17 cent per kilowatt hour price into the grid, when the wholesale market is up at $1.50.
Mm-hmm.
Solar is a complete bargain in that respect. But this gets complicated for people to try to it takes a while to explain this. Also, the average line losses, because we used to have major big generating stations. We had the Lakeview coal plant, the Nanticoke coal plant, nuclear plants at Bruce, Pickering, and Darlington. You know, these were big centralized plants, and if you lived anywhere else, the wire, you know, the electricity was going through hundreds of kilometers of wire.
Right.
And the average loss in Ontario is about 8%, which means
you
put in 100% and you only get 92 out. Well, with solar, the electricity is probably being used right in that building or right on that block or right on that concession road.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go very far. Like, it's being used immediately. And it also takes the strain off the grid because it's that much less that has to go through lines and transformer stations and everything else
to
get here. Cost money to have, and
when they go down, they cause a lot of problems. We want to cover on nuclear. So, do you want to weigh in terms of is there a party that
would
go that far on that, or just stick to nuclear?
Neither the Conservatives or the Liberals or the NDP seem to want to stop the process. The Pickering license renewal is up. I think it's in August, and from what I hear, it's probably going to go through because it would take something catastrophic to happen, like a Fukushima to happen here.
Right.
Doesn't matter that Fukushima happened or Chernobyl happened or Three Mile Island. It can't happen here, right? It seems like nobody is willing to derail that. I don't know if the Green Party has a position on it, but we don't need the power, and there's a very viable substitute. That 17 cents a kilowatt hour that I mentioned from nuclear, there's an offer on the table from Quebec Hydro to give us clean hydropower at 5 cents a kilowatt hour, fixed price for 20 years.
For 20 years.
And it's, we can have it when we need it and not take it when we don't.
So why wouldn't I, as a government, do that? Forget the nuclear for a sec, I guess. Or is it because I, the government, own, am I too invested in this nuclear thing? Because you're telling me I can buy for 17 cents from something that, if it does blow up, takes out the biggest city in the country. Or I can get it for a third the price that's mostly hydro, but regardless, it's being, everything's being done by somebody else. I'm just now the consumer. I can pay wholesale. Why am I not doing this?
Two reasons. One of them is that there's a concern about the loss of jobs. I think there's 3,000 people employed.
Okay.
Although there'd be a lot of decommissioning work. A lot. There'd be 10 years worth of decommissioning.
Same way you said.
High paid blue collar work.
Yeah, you do not turn off a nuclear, like you turn off a car. That thing will be taking, it'll be there for a while, even if it never puts another.
That's right.
Ounce of.
And like cars and the petroleum industry, the nuclear industry is one very big, very moneyed machine that would take a lot to stop. And I don't think there are any nuclear facilities anywhere in North America that are being built. There are several around the world that they've stopped construction midway through and just said, we can't afford this.
Okay.
And a lot of plants that have been decommissioned, in some cases, plants that have been perfectly good operating shape. It's just, they're just costing too much. And there's too much liability with the spent fuel that somebody's got to figure out how to deal with. So it's a, it needs to be something that we get away from. But the forces are against us.
Mm-hmm. So we're already over, which happens when I get going with a great guest, and it's, I think, my third week in a row where I go over, so big thanks, shout out to DJ Denim, who's probably going to send me an invoice for creeping in on his time, but I appreciate it, and to me that's a testament to the quality of the guests, so I really want to say a big thank you, Mike, to taking time out of your day to come out and speak with me. And hopefully we can do it again, because I know as happens is we touch on some stuff that leads to more, and there's more discussion to have. I'm pretty sure, I don't want to speak because I'm not a member of the party, but I believe I read that the Green Party is echoing, because of the, when you mentioned the Quebec
hydro
thing, I'm pretty sure you and I have not spoken about that
no.
recently, and I did know that. So I want to make, well, if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me, but I'm pretty sure the Green Party's position is... pick up the offer from Quebec. It makes sense. It's here now. It's a smart, safe alternative. And it sounds like an economical one, which is the part that just...
Yes.
Is the one, if nothing else...
should resonate.
Should, you know, and should... I would hope the folks... I know in my heart that the folks of Ontario are not... we don't always want to hear the truth, but when we hear the truth, we're not that good at ignoring it anymore. And the reality is... Doing good things for the environment is not anti-business, and it is not anti your own profits. And that's a myth that a lot of people like to carry around, which I think is very disingenuous, because a lot of people know better. But
yeah.
But if I can get hydro from Quebec, or electricity from Quebec, for a lot less money than any other way,
mm-hmm.
I think I should look into that.
Yep.
And if it turns out that on top of that I'm doing a lot of good for the environment, that's not a reason not to do it, which is really the argument. I'm taking it in reverse, because I'm starting with the economics, but that's the part that, you're right, people will trumpet the jobs. Nobody wants to put anybody out of work. I would think there's a lot of work there. There's a lot of work in solar.
There's a lot of work in renewables.
Right, and it's a growing industry.
Oh, yeah.
And it's well paying.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's clean and it's safe.
Exactly.
It's not too late.
I get there's a reason the people that work in nuclear plants get paid a lot of money, and it's not always because it's
they're smart guys.
Of the scarcity of the work.
Yeah.
But there's a big risk factor. They're working in a nuclear plant, and not everything is The Simpsons.
That's right.
It'd be nice to know that mom, dad, brother, son, daughter are working maybe in a safer environment, like something to do with solar, which is high tech. I mean, there's tons. We could go on.
We could ask this question. Mike Schreiner, the head of the Green Party, has a big rally in Guelph tomorrow.
Mm.
David Suzuki will be there.
That's right. That
Elizabeth May will be speaking. And
That's right.
I know Mike, so actually I'm going to ask him. It's probably in their party platform.
Like I said, I'm pretty sure I've seen it, and apologies to Mike that I'm not sure. But like I said, I'm. but thanks for bringing that up, because Mike was on the show. Has it only been a week? No, it's been 2 weeks. Mike was on in the studio with me 2 weeks ago. We had a great chat. We had a smart man.
Very knowledgeable guy.
Very, very smart. We did a bit of, or no, we did. He is much more diplomatic than me. But I was trolling the other leaders, so I may as well do that just quickly, if you'll indulge me, Mike, because we were talking at the time, the TV debates had not been officially announced, but we knew, and I mean, when I say we, I follow that stuff personally, and I remember from past elections that there was always this kerfuffle about who gets invited to debate on TV, but more importantly, who's doing the inviting. And for the folks that don't know, it's a private consortium built up of various individuals in the media industry, CHCH, CBC, taxpayer-funded, TVO, taxpayer-funded, Global, CTV. So individuals that are associated with those companies are on something, I have the name, Broadcast Partnership, blah, 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 some group. They set the rules. So anyhow, when Mike was on, Mike Schreiner, the announcements hadn't been made, but the expectation was that the three main parties would be invited and that's it. And that's exactly what happened. So I was trolling those leaders, Kathleen, who I kept calling Catherine. Maybe that's why she didn't answer me. I kept saying Catherine Wynn, maybe because of the rhyming. But Kathleen Wynn, Doug Ford, and Andrea Horwath to step up and say, hey, we would like Mike Schreiner at the table to debate. The reasons were simple, is that those four parties get taxpayer money. Those four parties receive funds from Elections Ontario, yet the Green Party kind of gets a pass and in terms of no ability for me to hold him accountable for what he's doing with that money.
Although Wynne stated publicly...
Since then, yeah, she didn't credit me.
She said
me.
they should be a part of this.
She did.
So although she said Doug Ford should be too. But wasn't.
Well, he's very busy making stuff up.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been on a bit of a personal crusade to, personal campaign, I take that first word back, personal campaign to see if I can't get the party leaders to agree. Look, that's all I'm saying. And I'm saying, you know, taxpayer money goes to those four parties. Now, whether anybody should be funded by the taxpayer, different discussion, and how they get funded, different discussion. I'm open to all those. Those are the facts right now. Elections Ontario, which is nonpartisan, decided that those four should get funds. Those four all run candidates in every riding in Ontario. So that's a pretty unique set of those four versus anybody else. But anyway, so that's where we're at today. So I don't know if Kathleen, Doug, or Andrew are listening.
There is a petition, by the way, online.
Fairdebates.ca.
Yes.
It passed. That's where Kathleen did come out in support to say she would like to see him included. Now that hasn't translated into action, so I don't know if that means that she's completely without power in terms of the Premier of Ontario has made that statement, and this private group of individuals in the media are all coming out of the media. Those companies I named earlier just don't care what she says. So somehow, I don't know, does that mean by definition Andrea and Doug have that much sway on this group? I don't know, because I don't know what prompts their decision.
There's a really high risk here, though. There might be just a whole lot of common sense introduced into politics, and I think that would shake things up a little too much.
You know, this is where I'm sort of, my plea on that one would be to go to Andrea and say, Andrea, I think you'd be okay with that, a little bit more common sense to sort of balance close to even it out a little bit. I don't know. Anyhow, that's not now I took it. I took us over there, but thanks again, Mike. So Mike Brigham, so Solar Share. So folks that do want to know more would go to
solarbonds.ca. Bonds like stocks and bonds. Solarbonds.ca. And the only qualification you have to have is to be a resident of Ontario.
Okay, and that's important. Thank you for mentioning that, because that's very important. Thank you very much, Mike. This has been In Studio with Kevin on CKMS 102.7 Radio Waterloo, reminding you that we broadcast on the FM dial at 102.7 on the internet, radiowaterloo.ca/listen, Rogers Digital 946.